Okay. Mm-hmm. Should we begin?
Yeah, sure.
Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, screaming into your internet echo chamber one painful episode at a time. My name's Jimmy and I voted to leave the EU in 2016.
And I'm Jazza and I've just come off the back of watching Hamilton, which was great, life-changing. But for me, it was less about a new nation throwing off the shackles of an overseas repressor and more a story of hope for a greater union that's able to stand up to international powers. I understand it's somewhat problematic to draw parallels between the foundation of the USA and the EU, slavery, for one thing, but it makes me feel better about my Europeanness. I want there to be kind of like a rap version of the foundation of the European Economic Area and kind of like have maybe like Jean-Claude Juncker as like the Hamilton of his day, I don't know.
I mean, there's less war involved in, you know, the starting of the EU, unless you count World War
II. Yeah, it's a lot less fun. Fewer duels as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's a slightly less exotic period. There's a lot more meetings in smoke-filled rooms
by
old white men.
But there is that that track on the Hamilton soundtrack about I want to be in the room where it happened.
There are some parallels, it's true.
Yeah? See? Hello, this is the Right Dishonourable podcast. We talk about politics, social issues, and current events somewhat weekly to your ears.
Just to track back a second. Whose shackles exactly are being thrown off in your EU version?
Oh, well, because people are like, oh, it's the Independence Day of the UK. Right, that's what Farage said. And there's this guy in Oxford who, on the anniversary of the vote last year, had like a big, like, gaudy sign saying, "Happy Independence Day." It's very annoying.
I bet that would work down well.
Yeah, Oxford is very, very Remain.
Didn't pitch it to the correct audience.
No. He seemed to be having a lovely time, though. Also, he must be pissed off because Leila Moran, the Lib Dem, is his MP.
Okay.
And she has a rainbow flag, a European flag, and a Union Jack in her office window, and I basically want to beat her. Anyway, how are you, Jimmy?
I'm fine, thank you.
Great, good. Yeah. What are we going to talk about this week?
What are we going to talk about this week?
Well, okay, fine, I'll tell you. So, Gary Young, a columnist, writer, person.
A columnist for The Guardian.
For The Guardian, wrote a thought piece, a think piece.
Opinion piece.
An opinion piece, thank you.
It wasn't necessarily thoughtful, but it was opinionated.
I mean, I feel like you're just being very nasty. I think it was very insightful. He wrote a piece about the significance of British history of having empire in the kind of like Little England attitudes that may have contributed to the Brexit vote.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we're going to talk about that because I think he's Gary Young is onto something. But Jimmy.
It's an incredibly original point of view. No one's ever mentioned that before.
Well, we haven't talked about it before, so there. clearly, we weren't original enough to come up with it ourselves, Jimmy. So.
I feel that all the opinion pieces that could have been written about Brexit were in fact written probably in about a month following the referendum, and they've just been repeating them on circulation at this point.
Well, the Guardian editor clearly thought that this was going to be... It was new information. So...
To who?
I don't know. Others. It's also... happy 100 years of women's suffrage. In the UK. Of some women. It's important we say some women. Because people got very annoyed when people were saying that. It's 100 years since women got the vote. It's 100 years since women over the age of 30 who owned property.
£5 worth of property.
£5 worth of property.
Or their husband.
Do we know how much that's worth in like today's money?
Quite a lot. That's the best I can do, I'm afraid.
Also, £5 would have probably gotten you like a house.
We could Google it, but...
That's not our style. It's not our style. So we're going to talk slightly about that. I liked the Channel 4 campaign.
Shouldn't we say also that it extended the vote to men
over the age of 21.
21 and over, yeah.
Also, who had property over... that? Like, they also needed to own property,
was there
property,
also
right?
Property qualification?
I think so,
wasn't it explicitly a vote extending it to working class men?
I mean, we literally just looked at the Wikipedia page for this. We should have really cemented
You looked at it, mate. I didn't. Oh, well, I don't think there was a property qualification.
You trusted me. But on this centenary of women's suffrage, there were also some protests, hunger strikes, actually. Although some people refer to it as fasting, which gave it kind of like a Ramadan feel, which I thought was particularly particularly.
I mean, a proper hunger strike should end up with you being force-fed, I feel. Whereas,
oh my God.
Otherwise, it is just fasting, like, you know.
It's just it's skipping a meal.
I've taken a day off eating. Not that impressive.
I'm on hunger strike right now. I only ate
because
an
you're
ago.
Not currently eating.
I'm not currently eating. But there was a hunger strike slash fast organised by the group Make Votes Matter, who want there to be a proportionate voting system in the United Kingdom. It was backed by Stephen Kinnock, the Labour MP, and Peter Tatchell. Is he still a Labour activist, or is he just a general troublemaker?
General troublemaker,
Peter Tatchell. And we'll talk about that and the importance of universal suffrage, and not just for the 300 or so seats that aren't safe seats. That's how I feel about it.
Not that you're bitter or anything.
No, it's really annoying living in safe seats. I've only lived in safe seats, and it just irritates me. Mm.
I just moved into Battersea, which is a Tory Labour marginal.
Oh, how gripping and exciting.
It is very exciting. Yeah, it's a new experience for me.
So kind of on the back of the women's suffrage, did you know we have a lady Prime Minister, Jimmy?
Do we?
Yeah, we do. Surprise!
Shit!
So Theresa May came out and did a speech on a happy centenary of... Suffragette Day. I don't know.
They need a better name.
I think there probably is an official name. I just have been blind. No, there isn't, is there? It's just 100 years since some women
suffrage
got
day,
the vote.
Female women... suffrage day.
Suffragette Day.
Some female suffrage day.
Votes for Women
all.
Day.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. So Theresa May did a speech that was a little bit about women's suffrage and... isn't it great? Two female prime ministers, BT Dubs, both conservative. What? And then
that is a good attack line. It has to be said.
It really is. but she also went on to talk about her plans to legislate against abuse towards parliamentary candidates
and party activists
as well, which has garnered a mixed response both within her party and without, and also Katie Price,
also known as Jordan,
I don't think she's been known as Jordan for a very long time. She was a glamour model and then reality TV. She has a son with various like learning difficulties called Harvey, and she keeps on doing public things with him, and he keeps on getting abuse online, and so she wants people to stop abusing him and calling him nasty names on the internet.
Yes.
And for there to be legislation backing it up.
And she appeared before a parliamentary committee that is investigating laws to that effect, roughly.
Worries me. But we're going to talk about the policing of quote-unquote...
On
abuse.
The internet.
It's a very dishonourable thing.
It is, yeah.
Isn't it?
We're
talking about Brexit, Brexit women, and freedom of speech.
That is very right, dishonourable.
It's like 4chan are our editors. That's how it sometimes feels, Jimmy, I'll be honest.
4chan is our editors.
Yeah. Like, these are like identity politics, Brexit, Trump, and... freedom of speech are like their thing, right?
I mean, these are pretty big issues generally, I think.
But because of them.
You think the political agenda is set by 4chan users?
I mean, literally, they pretty much elected Trump. Anyway, so we're gonna maybe I'm giving them too much credit. I'm gonna ask you for money in between some music bits, and then we're gonna crack on. Good?
Yep.
Yeah. Hello, dear listener. This is just a quick reminder that we are completely an audience-supported podcast. We completely depend on donations from people just like you to be able to keep on paying for like web hosting and the equipment and the time that it takes to put out this podcast on a weekly basis. It would be wonderful if you could join the family over at patreon.com and just pledge us like £1 or $1 or so to put some money towards giving us, buying us a drink, something like that. It'd be really nice. Thank you to the people who are already pledging for us. Thank you to Agatha, Dominique, Gemma, Matt, and Ollie. Ollie, you're going to get a Right Dishonourable mug in the post soon. It's very exciting for you. For anybody else who's joining, you can also, as well as pledging to get a mug, you can get badges and stuff like that. Ooh, ooh, sexy. Mm. I'm going to leave you now, and you're going to hear the episode. Okay, bye. George Young, the Guardian journalist, has written about his idea, which is original, as we said, that it is not necessarily the identity of the UK as kind of like the World War II, the one that stood alone against Germany in the Second World War.
Where is that a Churchill impression?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a very good one, thank you. Yeah. It was either going to be Gary Oldman or me.
Sure.
Yeah. It's less World War II, which has been suggested as a reason for us voting for Brexit with this strong sense of national identity, and more to do with the old kind of like empire of Britain and us as the major global power up until the 20th century. Mm. He brings up a really interesting point where a lot of the people who were at the forefront of the Leave campaign are in fact what I'm going to call sons of empire. So he brings up Douglas Carswell, who used to be the only UKIP MP before the referendum, was raised in Uganda, which used to be a British colony. Aaron Banks, who is evil, and bankrolled UKIP and the really quite horrific Leave.eu campaign, spent a lot of his childhood in South Africa, and his dad ran sugar estates in Kenya, Ghana and Somalia, so I'm sure he's got a lovely family there. Henry Bolton, the current head of UKIP, was born and raised partly in Kenya, and Robert Oxley, the head of Vote Leave, has family ties to Zimbabwe. I thought that was a really interesting... That's some interesting digging that happened.
I didn't realise any of their links to, you know, former British colonies in Africa. Mm-hmm. So,
To what extent do you think the suggestion by Gary Young is correct? Because you seemed to think that this article was stupid.
That's a direct quote.
It's literally a direct quote.
I'm very suspicious of columnists in general who try and diagnose the psychology of entire nations, because nations don't have psychologies as such. It is true that there are certain stories that we tell about ourselves in relation to our national identity, but I think it's very difficult to actually pin them down. And it tends to be more reflective of the political leanings of the writer and their own hobby horses as to what exactly they interpret matters. Me and you are both, young urban professionals,
for now,
non-professionals, who come from the southeast. I don't know anyone who gives a shit about the British Empire. Like it never comes
up. Of our age,
of even older, frankly.
I would hugely disagree.
Really?
The idea. So there's certain. I would disagree with you on these kind of like national myths that we tell us. I think actually I remember the Halcyon days when the biggest problem that we had was, oh, what even is Britishness? Like, oh, it's so like ethereal and hard to pin down. It's like jelly to a wall. And now it's Brexit. But we 100% part of our national kind of myth, and you need like a national myth in order to have a nation, basically. You need to have kind of like this idea of community and what is it that means that we are all in one place, and it needs to be more than we just happen to all appear on this damp, soggy rock in the North Atlantic together. And part of that national myth is very much we were this great empire trading nation, we gave India railways, we fought for democracy in Hong Kong, but not very well, and we stood against Germany. And I feel like and two World Wars, one World Cup.
Two, yeah.
All of that kind of stuff. I think that those really are the... And because those are kind of quite weak and detached narratives because it's been a very long time since we were that power, I think that 100% has been part of like the British identity for such a long time.
I'm not saying totally irrelevant. I just don't... I think it is very, that's a particular slice of how the British see themselves, but I don't actually feel it's that representative on the whole.
But don't you, so this was my experience with school, at least, and history in school. I learnt about the Tudors, the Victorians, World War One, World War Two, Victorians, World War Two, Stuarts, and then World War One, World War Two.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, that's anecdotal evidence from me.
I think it's pretty... I started to say this having not looked it up at all, but I think...
The Romans.
The Romans, yeah.
Caecilius Est in Horton.
I think most British school children learn about World War II disproportionately, in terms of it takes up a huge amount of the curriculum one way or the other. We both went to private schools, so we won't have followed national curriculums necessarily.
You still have to follow the national curriculum. Or you did
for exams, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
You've got more freedom to deviate.
You have a lot more freedom now with like free schools and academies and stuff like that. When I was at school anyway, we still had to follow the national curriculum.
But the World War II is actually quite different. I think you even said this in your introduction, is a different thing from the British Empire as a whole.
I agree. Shall we unpack that? How do you think they're different?
Well, apart from anything else, like the whole Britain alone narrative ignores the fact that Britain has an empire covering a quarter of the world's, you know, landmass.
Yeah, and we imported people from like the Caribbean and India and Australia and New Zealand to come and like fight for us because people was dying.
Yeah. but that's kind of...
And also, like, we were the Allies. We fought alongside the Allies. And granted, France wasn't great. France surrenders. but we were standing with like allied powers, and the United States basically saved our asses, right? And so this idea of the fact that we stood alone—there
was a point where in Europe at least, Britain was the one nation left standing that wasn't Germany or Russia, or you know, in hock with Germany at least. So that is kind of true. My understanding is that Britain probably could have defended itself for a long time on its own, but it never would have retaken Western Europe without the help of the US.
Mm-hmm. Or the importance of Russia on the eastern flank of Germany, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's an argument that Russia basically won World War II, and the Americans just pushed in from the... At least in Europe, obviously, the Japan's a different theatre. But to get back to the like original point, I just don't... Empire is part of Britain's national story. I wouldn't dispute that. I don't think it plays anywhere near the significance that Gary Young posits.
Do you not think that it plays into this idea of national exceptionalism? And this idea of us being... Like, this whole thing about like putting the great back in Great Britain and all of that kind of weird nationalist... Like, a lot of British nationalism does hinge on this idea of us being better. And I think that that's probably true for an awful lot of nations as well.
I mean, all national exceptionalism suggests that you're better in some way.
I don't know. Do the Irish think that? Write in.
I have no idea, to be honest.
Not sure. I feel like that story that we've told ourselves of being able to be this great expansive nation... Also, a lot of the suggested policies of people who are wanting for a particular type of Brexit, who want us to, instead of trading with the EU, trade with the Anglosphere, so trading with Canada, the US, Australia, New Zealand and South Africa.
I mean, the whole Anglosphere thing, I think, is actually quite a good representation of why Gary Young's wrong, in that the Anglosphere, which is basically, you know, it's Britain and the white colonies, more or less...
Sure.
Well, you know, the ethnically white colonies.
I mean, South Africa isn't ethnically white.
The narrow Anglosphere is Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Ireland. Sometimes it depends how you define it. It's variously defined. But their whole like the whole Anglesey thing is just it's so minor. No, like, so it's like an eccentric belief
in terms of like economic, like how much it would help us economically.
Yeah, but even like, even ideologically, it is not a popular idea. Uh-huh. Like, it's a very, it's an to say it is true that that did actually, it punched above its weight in terms of the Leave campaign, but in terms of Leave voters, it's negligible, I'd thought. Like, it really, no one believes in that, really.
In the, so nobody in Brexit believes that the Anglosphere is where we should be trading instead?
No, there are people advocating for that. I'm just saying, among Leave voters, the Anglosphere is not a mainstream concept whatsoever. It is an obscure concept.
I think that there is an idea that they would rather have more Australians than Romanians. I think that that, I think it, they wouldn't necessarily call it the Anglosphere, but they would perhaps say that they'd want people from culturally similar countries.
They do.
And it's probably coming from people who've never been to New Zealand, because New Zealand's a bit weird. I love New Zealand, but it is a bit weird.
There are polls that...
it's like somebody pressed pause in 1949.
There are polls that suggest that if you say, would you be happy with like an open border between the UK and Australia? And if you poll British people or Australians, the idea does have some traction. Mm-hmm. But I mean, even like there's like campaigns that pop up every so often to like get a free movement zone between Canada and the UK or something. Mm-hmm. And it's just so minor. It's... and no, like, no one really in government takes those proposals seriously, apart mm-hmm. from anything else. But yeah, I think it's a mistake to look at these actually pretty fringe figures and to extrapolate their views across the rest of the population.
I don't know. I think that there is some... I would disagree. I think that there is some resonance. Obviously, these are like the extreme views of people, but they are part of the zeitgeist, and they end, their ideas end up trickling into other parts of, like, just how Britain like manifests itself and comports itself abroad. I think that also India is a really interesting example of that. When Theresa May went on a visit soon after Brexit, and she was like trying to kind of... not, she wouldn't have been allowed to do a trade deal, but she was there to try and improve relations and improve business relations. And I think that there is an expectation that India is going to do whatever you want it to be, because it used to be ours, frankly. And India is a population of like a billion people.
I don't think anyone...
and a growing power. I think that there is something there, because there's this idea that we could go there and dictate the terms of a business relationship, whereas India has for decades tried to lobby the UK to make it easier for business people in India to get visas to go to the United Kingdom. Yeah. And that has persistently been a line that they want, and the UK has always said no. And the idea that Theresa May can, after Brexit, go to India and... offer the same deal that India have been offered for the past like however many years, and India's going to change its mind because it's old like parent coming back and asking for help, I think is kind of like part of this idea of British exceptionalism being the kind of paternal maternal figure across the world, and India couldn't give two fucks about us anymore apart from in cricket.
I mean, I just think the vision you're attacking there is a kind of guardian bogeyman that doesn't is not really very popular. You can go find like some old man in a pub somewhere in Margate or whatever, and he will say, oh yeah, you know, everyone's going to kowtow to us because we're the British and we used to have an empire and we have the Commonwealth, etc., etc. Those people do exist, but they're fringe cranks.
No, but you're thinking about the people that are going to explicitly say those things, whereas I'm thinking of people like my dad, who's like, oh, the empire was really good for Britain, was really good for India, and India actually wished that we were still ruling them. My dad's not a racist or an idiot, often, but that way of kind of like expressing that view, I think, is a relatively common thing that you would see an awful lot, and it is embedded in that idea of like British global paternalism.
Well, it might be because you've come across that view and I haven't, that you...
No, I am from deepest, darkest Essex, though.
But this is just like a cognitive bias thing. It's like, if you have experience of something, you probably think it's more common than it is. Mm-hmm. And I don't have experience, so I therefore dismiss it almost out of hand. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing in the Gary Young article that you know, quantitatively suggests how common the view he's attacking is, is my problem with it.
I think that that's quite hard to poll for, though.
I mean, I will say...
Because it would be difficult to ask those kind of questions in, like, any kind of poll.
Well, they did a... YouGov did a poll, of British people, do you think the British Empire was good or bad? I can't remember the exact phrase in the question. The majority, I think 2/3 or something, said that they thought it was positive. But I don't know exactly how to read that question. Do you know what I mean? If you ask people whether they think their country's good or bad, most people, I think, will be inclined to say it's good.
Right. You need to have sit-down conversations and anecdotal
evidence.
Well,
when you say the British Empire was good or bad, what exactly is
like, for whom?
Yeah, what do you mean by that? So it's... is something that you said previously, actually, that I wanted to go back to, the whole before Brexit we had this debate of, like, what does it mean to be British?
And it was often kind of jumped on by, like, the BNPs and stuff. A lot of people felt very awkward about flying Union Jacks for the reason of, like, right-wing nationalism.
I think the trouble is that, like, Britain, sort of at the end of World War II, was ethnically very homogenous. Mm-hmm. It was a... effectively an ethnic state that was created to actually, you'll see where I'm going with this.
Is for the listener at home, I'm giving him a look.
Like a lot of European, like, nation states, it was a state that formed out of a nation to a particular degree. And now, you know, 70 years down the line, Britain is a multicultural, it was relatively liberal in 1945, but it's now far more liberal. And when I remember in all those discussions about what it means to be British, people would list values, they wouldn't list ethnic qualities. But I think that's kind of...
I think that that's more of a European thing, though, right?
What do you mean? The values?
I think that... If you ask a French person, and I think that Frenchness is a lot more completely defined.
Yeah, I do agree.
I think because of, like, revolution and stuff, but it is very values-based rather than race-based.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say... I don't want to...
I actually think there are very few... I can't really think of any European nations that have a race-based... like an ethnicity-based identity.
But I think whenever you have these discussions about what it means to be British, there is kind of a... if you can list, like, values, like tolerant, liberal, accepting, open, and yet there are people who are undoubtedly British because they live in Britain and they're ethnically British. But they don't.
What is ethnically British, though?
I mean, the same thing that sort of ethnically German or ethnically Australian or ethnically.
But
whatever.
When you look at, like, genomes and stuff, they're the northern European genome is a mess.
Oh, I agree. I'm not saying it's like. It's a mythology, in a sense. And it's far more mixed
just
up.
Just making sure.
it's far more mixed up than it actually is.
Ethnically British, you mean just, like, white, right?
Not really, because there are some people that are white that are no categorisation ethnically British. Do you see what I mean? It's just... I mean, you're the one... Well, sorry. You would say that, like, undoubtedly sort of in the early 20th century, Europe and the States as well were very racist places by our standards. And my point is that Britain is kind of caught between the values-based idea of a nation, which would be more represented by progressive publications, by The Guardian, and a more ethnically centred view of itself. Do you see what I mean?
No.
No.
I think that we're caught between two kind of distinct cultures. And it's interesting that you use The Guardian as an example. I think it's caught between the culture of The Guardian and the Mail. And kind of like this idea of... how would you say? Like it's perhaps it's like fish and chips versus curry. But not even curry, because curry is seen as really British now.
Well, fish and chips is Jewish originally.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's almost like the history of the UK has been a very diverse island nation.
I mean, you mentioned the genome thing. Britain, even up until 1945, most of the people on the island, their families have been there for centuries. Like the diversification of Britain is a very recent phenomenon.
It's really not.
It really isn't, and I'll find you some things. But
during the Roman Empire, for instance, obviously Britain had far more migrants then, and then the Roman Empire retreated from Britain, and it became more homogenous, and there was less migration. Mm-hmm. It has fluctuated, but broadly speaking, the multicultural thing is a recent phenomenon.
And I just think you're wrong. I don't think you're wrong. I know you're wrong. There's huge waves of like Italian immigrants to Scotland.
I mean,
not proportionally. There's been centuries of Jewish families living in East London. There have been centuries of Afro-Caribbean people living in Bristol. Like it's.
There have been small groups, but the scale of it is very much a recent thing. I'm not saying there's always been some migration. Obviously, originally, we're all from Africa, so there has to be, it has to originate through migration. I'm just saying that the mass migration thing is recent. It's a recent phenomenon. That doesn't mean it's bad. Like, I still think migration is broadly really good, but it is recent. That's a historical fact, you know.
Yeah.
There are port cities which have had long traditions of, say, I mean, London is exceptional
London,
in that regard.
Liverpool has a really strange accent because of all of the accents that went through it.
Partly the Irish thing as well for Liverpool.
Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure how we got onto this.
What I'm saying is that, to bring it back to the Gary Young thing.
Thank God.
Is that Britain, my point is that Britain has a more kind of traditional mythology around being a kind of a nation in the old sense of like an ethnically homogenous group, which is undoubtedly how, like,
don't recognize that at all.
Oh well, that's kind of how I see it. But and now we have to move more towards a values-based thing, which is difficult for us because Britain was never defined really around values, I don't think. France or the United States, like the United States has like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. Britain doesn't have a version of that.
We don't have a constitution. And I think actually the Britishness that I think it's interesting that you think that the other extreme of kind of like ideals based identity is an ethno state. And I'm not sure I buy into that. Because I don't really see very much evidence of it.
Well, the British Empire. But, I mean, Gary Young would say the British Empire was a very racist empire.
Yeah, super racist. But I don't think that it was, like, British ethnicity that was... I mean, I don't know. Like, there was eugenics in the Victorian
era. You're sort of contradicting yourself there, because that's my entire point, is that we had a far more ethnocentric view of ourselves during the days of empire. I don't know why we've like charged down this rabbit hole.
Yeah. Do you mind if we climb up a little bit?
We probably should. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah. So I kind of believe in Young's kind of like hypothesis, and I think that the modern day kind of realization of that is not just Brexit, but also figures like Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg, who very much romanticize this kind of past ideal of the Victorian kind of like person. I don't know, like, so for example, so Boris Johnson reciting Kipling in Myanmar and not realizing that's probably not the best thing to do, and Jacob Rees-Mogg,
if you read the backstory to that scandal, quote unquote, it is actually the poem was quoted to him by one of the officials there.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. These are the kinds of things, like a very kind of like bumbling globe trotting, very old fashioned idea of like Britishness. And I think that these kind of caricatures of Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg very much come from like the Victorian era. What do you think about that?
There's a link between like the Victorian era and the idea of sort of classical liberalism and free market economics. Mm-hmm. There is kind of a link there. But again, like the whole Victorian thing, I think it's distinct from like the rule Britannia rules the waves. Mm-hmm. Kind of, they're linked, obviously. But the thing that when I read Gary Young's piece that I thought he was attacking was not necessarily the kind of buccaneering free trade element of the British Empire.
Mm-hmm.
Although I assume that he's somewhat opposed to that in its modern form of neoliberalism. I'm making like vast, you know, sweeping assumptions about this guy, but
I think you are. I think Gary seems quite nice.
I'm not saying he's a bad guy. I'm just trying to, you know, unpick what it is he's trying to drive at.
I think what he's trying to drive at is this idea of British exceptionalism and punching above its weight on an international stage, and the idea that we punch above our weight internationally, not because of the allies that we have, but because Britishness is exceptional. I think that that exceptionalism comes from the British Empire as well as other kind of narratives from the Second World War, for example.
Yeah, possibly. Mm-hmm. But
cool, I went. so it's 100 years since women over the age of 30 and
who had five pounds
worth of property.
Or their husband had £5.
We haven't Googled how much £5 was in 1918. I made you watch a spoken word poem from Channel 4.
Mm.
I'll look it up. I'm going to get you to react to the Channel 4 thing. So what did you think of the Channel 4 kind of like, it's like, you can't build, you can't vote, you can't blah, blah, blah. But then it says 100 years of women's suffrage and counting. And it's kind of implying that there's more to do for equality. What do you think?
I mean, it's true that men and women like don't have parity in a lot of areas. Some of the ones that we previously discussed are things like women do not make up 50% of FTSE 100 boards. Women do not make up 50% of Parliament, either in the Commons or the Lords. So there's lots of, like, they just don't fill certain jobs in the same numbers that men do. And women just generally have different expectations of what is correct or appropriate behaviour put upon them than men do.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose the obvious debate then is, will some of those things are actually just like are just bad, like the sexual harassment Harvey Weinstein thing is just
the Me Too campaign.
Yeah, stuff like that is just out and out bad and is a matter of social progress. But the other side of it is, I guess this is like the big debate in feminism, which we probably referenced previously. But are men and women ever going to be the same across the board? If you see what I mean, or there's a distinction between like social problems, which that campaign highlighted,
right,
versus parity, equality of outcome, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Well, Theresa May talked about this in her speech, which we'll come on to a little bit later as we segue into the next topic. But she talked about the fact that women are different do tend to be different in their approach to leadership. You'll quite like that. And how you can get equality of outcome, but it is a different process. And there tends to be an intolerance of a different of process towards a same or similar outcome when it comes to the way that women lead and the way that women work in politics or business, all those kind of things. And I think that there is something to say for the fact that you can get to the same or to better goals with increased female-like voices and those kind of things. But that is often stopped because the process is seen as ineffective. Do you see what I mean? What do you think of that hypothesis?
Sorry, the process is ineffective.
So the way that a woman manages or the way that a woman leads is often interpreted as ineffective by the institutions that she's in, because those institutions are used to having a male style of leadership or management. But Theresa May would argue that women can get the same, or like she never says better, but I'm going to say better. Women can get the same or better outcomes if the infrastructure
or worse, presumably.
Women are allowed to be worse. if the infrastructures that surround them actually were accepting of and supported the ways that they tend to, obviously we're talking about like,
and that's kind of an equality of opportunity outcome, isn't it? You're saying the architecture is such that even though women could do just as good a job on average, they aren't allowed to be, that's probably true to some degree. I mean, it's probably also true that men and women have different appetites for certain jobs, including, you know, psychopath CEO jobs where you work 120 hours a week and never see your family and kids.
Mm-hmm. You know. Well, and they don't seem fun for anybody.
Well, some people obviously enjoy them. I would just suggest that the sort of people who would enjoy that kind of super high pressure job are more likely to be men than women.
Do you think it was important for us to highlight the fact that this was only suffrage for a certain number of women? £5, by the way, the amount of property that a woman had to earn before she was able to vote was equal to £262.24
in today's money. That's not that much.
It isn't, but I'm assuming houses weren't like £500,000 in the East End back then.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like that much.
I don't know. I'd be happy.
300 quid will, you know, get you clear.
Yeah. doesn't seem like a lot, but I feel like property was definitely a lot cheaper back then.
Maybe there's something wrong with that calculation, or we're not accounting for some factor.
Well, www.in2017dollars.com /GreatBritishPounds do you think it's important that we talk about the fact that this was only partial enfranchisement, and also extending the vote to only men over the age of 21?
I mean, not really.
I mean,
they changed it later. If it was still the case, if it was still the case that you had to be 30 and have 260 quid, then yeah, I think it would be worth talking about. Otherwise, it's a minor historical detail, surely.
Do you think that at the time, obviously you weren't there in 1918, Jimmy.
I was
otherwise,
not.
Otherwise, if you were, then you have some explaining to do. But do you think that there was... Why do you think it was only suffrage that was... kind of like not the same as their male counterparts?
But bearing in mind, I know very little about the...
As a representative of the early 20th century.
Specific circumstances. Uh-huh. I would guess that it was probably far more possible for, you know, the politicians championing this reform to get an unequal voting system between men and women, but to still get women some votes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, you know...
The argument for that. It's kind of like a similar thing to why the Labour government in the early 2000s, or the mid-noughties, they put into place civil partnerships before getting married.
Couples, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's often easier to do things by increments than by radical reform. So I assume that's the reason, but...
One can...
If you want to know the answer, listeners, please Google and you will find out...
I've already had to Google how much £5 was worth. I'm not doing it again. As we said in the introduction, the celebration of the 100 years of women's suffrage was kind of... It wasn't so much hijacked. It was largely ignored, I think, to be honest, by a lot of mainstream media. But there was a protest, a hunger strike, or a fast, whatever, to raise awareness for... true universal suffrage. Mm-hmm. So for every vote in the UK to be worth the same, and for there to be a proportionate voting system in the UK, mm-hmm. as opposed to the first past the post system that we have at the moment.
Yep.
This was organised by Make Votes Matter, Stephen Kinnock, who's a Blairite.
Yeah, he was famously filmed on election night 2017.
Yeah,
talking up how bad shit Corbyn was going to do, and then mm-hmm. had to eat shit when Corbyn got 40% of the vote.
He's also married to the old Prime Minister,
Denmark.
Not the old, the ex-Prime Minister of Denmark.
Yeah.
More you know. So some top
there's
lines.
In that documentary I just referenced, there's an amazing clip where he's about to like give an interview at like 2 a.m. to BBC or something, and his wife comes up to him and goes, "What the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
You have nothing to say." It's like, "Oh yeah, I do have nothing to say." That's why she's ended up as Prime Minister and he's just some Welsh MP. offense to the guy.
also maybe more women leadership.
Maybe they'd
shut the fuck up more.
Men probably should shut the fuck up more generally. But
I'm glad you agree. So some top lines on the current voting system. So there are 368 seats that are so safe that the Electoral Reform Society calls their result before an election, like when an election is called,
announced.
Before like people actually go to the polls. So that's like over half of the seats in Parliament are safe seats.
How many did you say?
368. That is over half.
That is over
Don't
half.
Make me question my math. That's 25.7 million voters whose votes don't really matter.
arguably.
I mean, from a mathematical point of view, nobody's vote matters. Sorry, mate. Sorry to bring that up.
Not part of the narrative that we want to tell the listeners, is it?
You should vote, but not because it matters. Not because your vote actually changes anything, because it doesn't. You know, straight up. And actually, your vote will change even less if we move to a proportional system. But the proportional system's still better.
Yeah.
For other reasons.
Do you think that there is a case to make about this idea that kind of universal suffrage, the idea that everybody's vote counts, can be remedied by a completely proportionate representation, a proportionate voting system, or like proportionate representation in some form?
I mean, I think proportional representation, I'm not like set on what form it should take, but I would prefer some kind of system to what we have now, first past the post. I think it's a difficult sell because, as we found out in the alternative vote referendum, which is...
Well, the AV is not a great...
It's not great, but it's better than first past the post, right?
Yeah,
so
the
way AV works is that somebody to win a constituency seat has to win more than 50% of the vote. So if nobody gets that on the first round, you start eliminating... what is it? You pare it down to two candidates and then people's second preferences taken into account, which is the way they do the London mayoral election. And it is better than first past the post, but it's not... It's not as representative of national opinion as a proportional representation system would be. But it's a difficult sell because even that is like quite esoteric and technical as far as most people's giving a shit about politics stretches. I think the reason that no one's reformed it is because it's not...
Because it was famously in the manifesto of the 1997 Labour Party.
Was it?
Yeah.
I didn't realise that.
Voting reform, yeah. It was off of the back of, I think, Germany had recently changed their voting system, New Zealand had recently changed their voting system to more proportionate versions. And they chickened out. Although, when Labour created devolved parliament in Scotland, they introduced a proportionate voting system.
Well, the trouble is that whoever's in charge has a very strong incentive not to change the voting system because they're winning on that system. Because if Blair, 97, wins a huge landslide and then changes the voting system to a proportional representation one, he then has to go into coalition government when the next election's called because... apart from in Scotland, no one ever wins a majority in a proportional representational voting system. So I think it's a good idea. It's just a tough sell, just because it's boring. It's really important, but really boring.
What did you think about that link between like women getting the vote and making all votes matter?
It's fine. I see why they did it, but like, you know. Being pro-women is so, like, on the media agenda at this point.
I'm pro-women, I'm pro-men, I'm pro-everybody. Everybody loves me.
You know what I mean, though? Like, with the Me Too... I mean, that Channel 4 thing that we referenced earlier had a whole load of hashtags, like everyday sexism, equal pay...
Free the nipple.
Free the nipple. I have no idea what that is.
I'll tell you later.
Okay.
It's probably my favourite social media company.
But that's, like, far more in the public zeitgeist than... an argument about sort of equal voting or
it's a very
better
like
voting
it's a
systems.
Very technocratic kind of grievance, right? It's like, oh well, this is the current system doesn't allow for my vote to actually be representative, and the person who is my representative doesn't represent me.
Yeah, the whole like women's issues are just more emotive than voting systems.
Yeah.
So apparently it pissed off quite a few people, at least on Twitter. There were a few.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I felt about doing like a hunger strike for.
That was a bit tacky.
Yeah,
and also, it's not really hunger strike, is it? Like,
no, it was a fast.
Yes.
Yeah, cool. So, it was 100 years since ladies got the vote. Very good. Lovely. Theresa May did a speech that was kind of meant to celebrate the fact that she's a lady, she's the Prime Minister, in case you missed it. And she was going to be celebrating 100 years since women got the vote. And she... chose actually to talk more about the possibility of bringing in legislation to protect people running for political office from like abuse online, essentially. How much of this do you think is tied to the fact that she is behind the campaign, what was it called? Women to Win, that she ran for the Conservatives. There is the kind of like this idea that a lot of women choose not to run for political office because of the toxicity in political discourse. Do you think that this is meant to be an antidote to that?
So the Women to Win thing, which was to get more parliamentary conservative female parliamentary candidate, and did work.
Oh, it is working.
Yeah. Although Labour still have far more female MPs than
because they have shortlists. They have a much more what's it called?
Discriminatory system is what they have.
I think I was looking for affirmative action.
Positive discrimination.
Yes.
<correct. laughs> Well, not positive for
isn't
the men
language,
who discriminate.
Isn't
against.
Language fascinating?
What was the question?
She's tying this idea of a lot of women choose not to run for office because of the abuse that they might get, and protecting political candidates online.
So
it was interestingly just targeted towards like political candidates, right?
Yeah. So there's the Joe Cox thing, who obviously
Joe Cox was murdered.
Was murdered by a far right lunatic. For ostensibly for her views on Syrian refugees or something like that. But that's like the kind of pinnacle example of like the toxicity of current political debate. I will point out though, because it seems to me that this has been kind of lost, is that actually political campaigns have often been horrendously like ruthless. I mean, there's the... or just really toxic and ugly in their own way. There was, I think in the 70s or something, there was a Tory candidate who ran with the slogan of something like, if you want a nigger from a neighbour, vote Labour.
I hate that you use that word. It's okay, I know you're quoting it, blah, blah,
it's,
blah.
It's a quote. It's not an approving quote either, but there was that. There was Peter Tatchell, who we mentioned earlier, the gay rights campaigner, ran as a Labour candidate in Bermondsey.
Southwark.
Was it Southwark?
Against Simon...
Hughes.
Yes.
But he was subject to like horrendous homophobic abuse throughout. And actually, bearing in mind he was fighting Lib Dems, he wasn't fighting Tories.
It was Liberal back then.
Liberal, sorry. So there's actually a history of like political nastiness. Right.
Also, wonderfully, ironically, Simon Hughes came out as bisexual in the early 2000s.
Yes, that is ironic. I think it's the social media thing, there is unpleasantness, but I actually think that people have sort of lost perspective of how nasty political campaigning has been in the past. So that's kind of worth bearing in mind, I think.
So she has proposed in the talk that she did up in Manchester, which is an appropriate place. I did my undergrad in Manchester, and there's a lot of that was the hub of like the suffragette movement and a lot of like workers' rights movements and stuff. It's a really, really great city with some good history.
Are you on commission, mate?
Yeah.
For the tourist board of Manchester.
So, yeah, exactly. Me and Andy Burnham, thick as thieves. So she proposed an annual internet safety transparency report, which would provide data to what offensive content is happening on social media platforms. A law commission review of the legislation relating to offensive online communications, so that we can confirm whether or not the current legislation is actually being enforced, and the publication of a social media code of practice that she wants to bring out later this year, setting out clearly the minimum standards expected of social media platforms. This seems to very much be in the vein of a lot of UK legislation when it comes to kind of like tech platforms and social media platforms of, guys, you need to sort your shit out. Hey, Twitter, can you stop there being abuse on your platform when Twitter does not exist within the jurisdiction of the United Kingdom, and all the UK can really do is block Twitter if they really wanted to.
What do you mean it's not within the jurisdiction exactly?
Twitter's internal policies they're not necessarily going to have to adhere to legislation that the UK rolls out. It's going to be very difficult to actually enforce it.
You say that, but the right to be forgotten ruling, which was a European Court of Justice ruling, principally against Google, for continuing to list search results relating to a Spanish lawyer going bankrupt, that at the time there was a lot of controversy as to how that would be applied, but actually Google chose to effectively enforce it. So if people want to delist,
mm-hmm. It was only within national hostings though. So it was like all of the EU domain names, .co.uk, .eu, .es for Spain, .de for Germany. Those were the ones that had to be, because they were in within the EU.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm sure it is complicated, but it seems to me there's an emerging model of how to actually enforce legislation for, you know, transnational websites.
Mm-hmm. And there does, we should probably say there is legislation, I can't remember the name of it, is it GDPR? There's a piece of legislation that's just come in, or is coming in, within the EU for social media companies to have more... to be more transparent about the kind of stuff that they collect on the people that use their platforms.
I don't know if that would be the General Data Protection Regulation. It might be.
I think it is. There you go.
The GDPR does include the right of erasure, which means, in theory, if you contact...
It's the right to be forgotten, essentially, isn't it?
The right to be forgotten is the search engine delisting thing. Mm-hmm. The right of erasure...
Oh, for you to ask them to delete the data.
Yeah. So if they don't have a compliance reason to hold the data... Mm-hmm.
And it does seem like they're adhering to that legislation. Like, there's been a load of hires across the European Union for people who are going to be... doing these jobs.
Yeah, I mean, the whole data protection industry has really taken off since GDPR started being written.
So, Theresa May said, a truly plural and open public debate in which everyone can take part is in danger. A tone of bitterness and aggression has entered into our public debate. Do you think that that's Twitter's fault?
Not on their own, but I think the... essentially, like, the internet has made all forms of communication easier, including abusive forms of communication. So mm-hmm. once, where if you hated an MP, you'd send them, like, shit in the post or something, or just an abusive letter. You now just have to, like, at them on Twitter and then say, you're a cunt and I hate you.
Uh-huh.
So I think the difficulty is that it's very hard to delineate, I guess, what could be seen as, like... productive language that can sound abusive, or like, you know, political opinions put stridently against just like abuse that has no real purpose. Like, if you say, you know, I really hate the Tories, or it's different for when you're targeting organizations versus people, but if you say, I think Theresa May is a fascist,
there was that interesting case with libel in France with Marine Le Pen. Like, a publication called her fascist, and then she took them to court for making a libelous claim, and then the court decided that she actually was a fascist.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, that's why politicians don't sue for libel, generally speaking. But yeah, I think it's difficult to... Like, if you say Theresa May's a fascist, Theresa May does have some authoritarian policies, including... the sort of her general stance on internet surveillance and security is very authoritarian.
Mm-hmm. I think she'd prefer maternalistic.
Yes, maternalistic authoritarianism. But I mean, is that, if you call her a fascist, I suppose in a narrow sense that's incorrect, because fascism is a particular political movement, but in the sense of you want to control people, it's abusive, but is that fair comment, or like, where do you define the boundaries around that? I think it's very difficult.
So that was kind of echoed in a piece from her own side on Conservative Home, which is the Conservative Home.
It's an activist like run website, like Conservative members.
Yeah, so. It's like a big house where all the Conservatives live.
Not all of them, I wouldn't say. No. Some of them, for sure.
All 12 of them. So Mark Wallace, the executive editor, criticised her proposals for legislation, saying that... So this is a common kind of rebuttal to the idea of legislating against speech. So she said, he said that threats and intimidation are already criminal offences. If the police are already failing to protect candidates and activists from behaviour that is already illegal, will creating a new category for the same offences really make any difference? I probably agree with him.
Yeah, I mean, I think David Ellen Green, the lawyer who comments a lot on Twitter on Brexit-related matters. I think it was him that was discussing, it might have been the secret barrister, were discussing how, it was actually the secret barrister, was discussing how there are already laws in place to tackle this abuse, right, and what's the point of writing another law to carry out the same function. If the current law is not working, the thing to do is to rewrite that law rather than just heap on mm-hmm. extra legislation.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty difficult. I'm not convinced they'll get the balance right, but I also think that defending free speech is not... we talk about free speech quite often, but most people don't fundamentally care about free speech, I don't think.
They've never had their freedom of speech taken away from them.
Well, no, it's just that some people would say, well, if someone's being a dick, then shouldn't we shut them up, basically, or punish them in some way, without thinking mm-hmm. that it's difficult to do that and actually still, as I said, the
'cause who decides when somebody gets shut up?
Yeah, but basically, who decides what's productive if, like, mm-hmm. strident speech versus unproductive speech?
Loads of times that I've wanted to shut you up.
Yeah.
I'm assuming it's accidental that Katie Price was also advocating for very similar legislation, I feel.
But not for politicians.
No,
so
Theresa May's was specifically for people who are campaigning for office.
Yes.
And Katie Price, the ex-glamour model, was in front of the select committee, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Talking and advocating for legislation for making online abuse of individuals illegal. I'm not sure. So she said that it's specifically about her son who has several disabilities, gets an awful lot of abuse online. I don't know how to say this in a PC way, but I am like, you are putting your son in the public eye, and he can't necessarily consent to that because of his disabilities. Should you? I don't know how she made the
argument that people with disabilities should be in the public eye, though.
I agree.
Which is true.
Yeah, I agree with her.
So you're right that it is a bit dicey on some level.
Yeah, that kind of. Like I've not heard that put to her actually defending it. I would have liked to have heard that directly from her, but maybe she has said it and I haven't seen it.
Yes.
Never mind. I'm awkward now. The thing is also, like, social media is not the only place where nasty things are said about people. I'm sure there's plenty of times that newspapers have also said nasty things about her son. And she doesn't seem to be.
I'd be skeptical about that. Like, it's, I don't know that many newspapers would. I'm sure she gets a lot of, like, in below the line comments on, mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. so, you know, the Daily Mail and that sort of thing. I'm sure she does get a lot of abuse one way or the other. But I doubt a newspaper would go after her son.
Yes. I think, actually, you're probably right. What do I fucking know? I feel like the same arguments that were put by Mark Wallace of a Conservative Home to Theresa May exist here for wider individuals. Like, who is it that ends up deciding? We have already got like threats and intimidation legislated against. If you want, we should be enforcing that rather than creating like a happy social media environment for absolutely everybody online.
On some level, does...
create an intranet that blocks Twitter so your son can't see it.
Does Katy Perry's son... Is that Katy Perry? Katy Price's son.
Different people.
Or Katy Perry's son, if she ever has a son.
Very different people.
Okay, what right does someone have not to be insulted or abused? Mm-hmm. To what extent do you have that right? I mean, if somebody listens to what we've said and wants to, you know, tweet at us, I think you're both dipshit cunts who know nothing about anything. You're ignorant. Your arguments don't add up.
I know you made up that comment, but that cut deep.
You know what I mean, though. Like, you've been on YouTube for ages, so you've got like loads. I mean, you've had like
I've been doxxed before.
Lots of experience of different forms of abuse.
Yeah,
but some of it is like, I don't think it should be illegal to say horrible things about Katie Price's son. I don't think people should do it, but I don't think it should be illegal.
Yeah, I agree.
So, but I think that most people will see Katie, this is a good example of it actually, most people will see or read that article and go, yeah, she's right, her son doesn't deserve to be abused and we should write some laws around that.
No, and that's what kind of terrifies me, because it simplifies, like, an argument that can have huge sweeping consequences.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, already a lot of people have been... the police are always arresting people for saying shit on Twitter.
They are often... It's often very hard to legislate, but they do now take those kinds of things seriously. And the way that the police deal with those kinds of issues does seem to be getting better. And it's taken time for them to be able to do that. So back in 2009, when I was doxxed, the police were like, eh. Literally, they were like, well, I don't know what I can do about it. Whoopsie. And now I don't believe that that would happen.
But I mean, on one level, like, so doxing is when they release your address mm-hmm. and other contact details. But on some level, if I know your address details, it's not illegal for me to release them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they did it to intimidate you, presumably, which is bad. But I mean, it's like the whole thing of if someone's in court for something, often they their address is read out to confirm their identity. Mm-hmm. It's not illegal to publish that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, generally newspapers don't do it, mm-hmm. but if someone was just sitting in a public gallery,
but they do turn up in droves at their houses.
Who do?
Journalists sometimes. Journalists.
Yes, they do doorstep people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is the thing. I'm not sorry about that. Like, it's not illegal to go up to someone's door and ask them for a call. It is unpleasant sometimes for people, but it's that thing of like free speech requires that you allow some degree of unpleasantness.
Mm-hmm.
And being in a free society, to some degree, also requires that you allow some unpleasantness.
Mm-hmm.
It's where do you draw that line? And again, I think in the case of Katie Price and all, it's... I don't really see how you can draw it, to be honest.
Vote for Jimmy 2022. Shall we wrap up?
Yeah, sure.
So you can find us on Twitter at Right Dishonour, and you can find us on the internet on www.rightdishonourable.com. We are individually on Twitter if you have something to say to either one of us. I'm at Jazza John and Jimmy is at JDE Nichols. Leave us a review on iTunes, for goodness sake. I've not got anything to, like, it's fun sometimes. Love us. Oh, also, yeah, subscribe. Okay, bye.